broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
The young man with the tattoo covering his face tells me he has ridden his 62 Panhead from Oregon to Maine to pick up his girlfriend. Now they're on their way south to who knows where, towing the old cycle, its bored out engine used up. It's hard not to stare at the tribal swirls and stitches and darts and dashes, the sunbursts that blacken his face, the lines that uncurl from under his shirt sleeves, his cutoffs. And I worry about the woman traveling with this man whose skin is a shield held against the world. Rest Stop, 87 Miles from Asheville, by Linda Blasky. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. My guest today is Linda Blasky, a leader and animator now. Now that's a word for you, isn't it, animator? Of the Coastal Writers, a writing group that meets in Rehoboth, Delaware. Accompanying Linda are three members of the writing group, Liz Dolan, Irene Fick, and Margaret Foster. They will share some of their work with us a little later in the program. Linda is also the coordinator of the Dogfish Head Poetry Prize. And Linda, I think you were on the program, was it 2 years ago, I think now, 2013, to talk about the Dogfish Head Poetry Prize, weren't you?
Yes, I was. And Tina Ray Dayton, who was the winner that year, was with me.
Yeah, Tina is a local poet, I think, here in Salisbury, and quite a good poet as well. I believe the submission period is open for the 2015 edition of the contest, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It opened on Memorial Day, and it closes at midnight on Labor Day, which I believe is September 7th.
Well, tell us a little bit about the Dogfish Head Poetry Prize.
It used to be for chapbook-length manuscript, and now it's for a book-length manuscript, which is 48 to 78 pages of original work. It's open to poets that live in Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, West Virginia, and the District of Columbia.
Did I see North Carolina? No.
North Carolina.
North Carolina.
Yes, North Carolina.
You guys are working your way south with this with this contest, aren't you? You'll be in Florida before too long.
Well,
now.
We're trying to open it up to all the states where Dogfish Head is distributed.
And what's Dogfish Head for those outside our broadcast area who will listen to this on podcast or streamed?
Dogfish Head is a brewery. It's based in Milton, Delaware. They have a restaurant in Rehoboth, but they produce Dogfish Head beers.
No, I know my son lives in Massachusetts, and he drinks Dogfish mm-hmm. Head beer. Not too much, I hope, but that is his preference. And what kind of poetry are you looking for? What kind of entries are you searching for?
Any kind. We don't take translations, but any style of poetry. We actually have an entry this year that's a book of prose poetry. I should say that the prize is $500. It's publication of your manuscript, of which you get 10 copies. You can buy more at cost. You get two cases of Dogfish Head beer. And you get to spend a night at the new Dogfish Inn in Lewis, Delaware. And the presentation is given in December, and it's a party. It's with beer and food provided. Last year it was at the brewery in Milton.
Is there a fee associated with entering your poetry?
There is no entry fee.
So there's no entry fee. And they just, well, tell us, how do people enter? How do they find out where to send their poetry?
You can find the guidelines on, it's the BroadkillRiverPress.com, and there's a link that says more. You click on more, and it Dogfish Head Poetry Prize is there. Or you can email me at linblask, L-I-N-B-L-A-S-K, at AOL.com, and I'm happy to send you the guidelines.
Well, Linda, in addition to working with the Coastal Writers and coordinating the Dogfish Head Poetry Contest, you're also the poetry and interview editor for the Broadkill Review. What's the Broadkill Review, and how does one get the Broadkill Review?
The Broadkill Review is a literary journal. It was started, 9 years ago by Jamie Brown. It arrives, it's by subscription. If you subscribe, you get your issue. It arrives in your email. And you can download it. It's in PDF form. You can download it to your computer. It comes out 6 times a year. We publish poetry, interviews, fiction, essays, book reviews.
And what do you do, Linda, as the editor of the poetry portion of the Broadkill Review?
I receive submissions. I go through them. I either accept or reject. I have chosen, for our fiction submissions, you go through Submittable, which is a submission manager. I've chosen to have people send poetry directly to me because Submittable puts up a barrier between you and the poet, and I would rather work one-on-one in a more personal way with the poet. And I just prepare the poems. When Jamie's ready for them for the next issue, I email him to it.
And you're also interview editor. What do you do as interview editor for the Broadkill Review?
Well, I was actually the interview editor before. I was the poetry editor, and Jamie asked me to be the interview editor, and I naively said, sure. And he said, okay, your first assignment is Robert Pinsky, who used to be the Poet Laureate of the United States and probably one of the better known poets in our country. And I was scared to death. But then I had a conversation, questions back and forth with Mr. Pinsky, and he was wonderful and kind. And kind of understood, I think, that this is the first time I did that. Once I completed that interview, I relaxed a lot, and I've since interviewed Maxine Kuhman and Linda Paston.
Now, for our listeners, who are these people that you're interviewing?
Maxine Kuhman was also held the post of Poet Laureate of the United States. It had a different title at that time, and I can't remember what it is. Linda Paston was Poet Laureate of Maryland for years. They've both served on, I think, the board of the American Poets.
Mm-hmm. You interview local poets as well and local writers for the Broadkill Review as well?
I interviewed Josh Izzard, who teaches creative writing at a university in Pennsylvania. I have interviewed winners of the Delaware Division of the Arts grants. I actually interviewed Irene Fick when her chapbook won a national prize. So, yeah, I do local also.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you about more about the Broadkill Review. The it's out 6 times a year. Does it come out in paper, or is it an online review, or how does one receive it?
You receive it in your email. It's only online, but it's in a PDF format. So if you subscribe 6 times a year, you get an issue, and you download it to your computer, where you can keep it forever. You can keep it on your computer, or you can print it off, but it's usually about 60-some pages long.
I've read the Broadkill Review, and I noticed the May June issue is 102 pages. Now that's a huge that's a huge piece of work, it seems to me.
It is, and I will say that when Jamie started it, I think the first issues were maybe 35 to 40 pages long, but it's really grown. We have about 10,000 readers, and not just in the States. We have an editor in Australia, and she covers the Southern Pacific Rim. We have submissions from all over the world. The thing is, when you get the link that you can download to your computer, that link is open for 2 weeks. You can share that issue with as many people as you want.
The one of the things that interested me is in reading through one of the issues, I came on a whole group of poems in French. Now, Linda, do you read French? And who are your French readers? That do you have a Canadian edition, or is this the Paris edition?
I do not read French, and if it's the issue that I'm thinking of, that particular poem, it was very long, and I believe it was in sections, was originally published in English in the Broadkill Review, but then a French magazine accepted it, and the author and the editor of the French magazine translated it. And Jamie, who's very enthusiastic and supports his contributors, wanted to publish it in French as the French magazine had published it. So he republished it in the Broadkill Review.
Well, I have to say it looked terrific in French, quite frankly. The coastal writers is a writing group that I don't know if you helped found it. I did read that you are one of the last original members of the group, but tell us about the coastal writers and your participation with that group.
Well, we've been around since 1999, and I am the last of the original members. Liz Dolan, who's here today, is the next to last, I guess you would put it that way. So we're the grandmothers of the group. The amazing thing about this group is since 1999, we have met every week for, 15 years?
Yep.
Yeah.
And what do you do, and how are you organized, and what happens at the Coastal Writers group when you meet?
Well, it's a critique group, mm-hmm. So we bring our work and we share it, and people make comments on what needs to be improved or what's working perfectly. We're solely a critique group. I think another unique thing about it is we have no leader. We've never had a leader. Every single person in the group has equal value, carries equal weight, can bring up concerns at any point, can suggest changes in the way we're working. And that creates, I think, a family situation where we're all good friends. Another unique thing is when we're critiquing someone's work, that person may not speak. They have to sit quietly while we don't address them. We speak amongst ourselves. They listen. And when we're finished, they can ask questions. The one hard rule that I think we have is that you may not explain your work. You may not defend your work. Because if you have to do that, then it's not working. But at the end, the author whose work we're talking about can then ask questions. So
the questions that would seem to me might be able to take on an instructive quality in itself or a defensive quality in itself, because who can sit there and listen to someone critique your work without drawing your sword at some point and in some way? I don't know. As a writer, it seems to me.
Well, amazingly, that rarely happens because we're not a rip each other apart group. We're a supportive group. And usually the questions at the end are to clarify something that somebody has said.
Yeah.
Along those lines.
Do you have you've mentioned a little bit about a critique style. Where did you come up with this critiquing style? And are there, for the people doing the critiquing, are there rules or is there a set pattern that they need to follow?
No, actually it gets kind of rowdy at times. We came up with our style through a poet and friend whose name is Jerry LaFemina. He teaches at Frostburg. And he explained to us that this is the style that most universities use. And the reason they use it is it prevents fighting. It prevents the person whose work we're working on jumping in and arguing. So that's why we adopted that style. And it works very well. We do not go in order. We read the piece at the meeting. And then we discuss it. And whoever wants to start jumps in.
What is I guess what I'm trying to get at is what is the format of the discussion? What are when people critique a piece, what are they looking for to say about this piece? What are they looking for in the piece? And I realize that's unique to the individual piece, but people, you have to have something in mind when you're beginning to critique someone else's work.
I would say most often it's a case of if there's some syntactical error, somebody will point that out. Or sometimes if a word is used, I remember in a poem of mine, I used the word surreptitious, and it bothered some people because they didn't feel that it fit with the poem. So after these comments are made, like maybe a better way to say a line or a better place to break a line, I'm talking about poetry now, then it's up to the author to take that advice or not. And it's basically the same thing with prose. If somebody is describing a scene and they go to the next scene and the leap isn't clear or confusing, we'll point that out, you know.
Well, we have three members of this critique group with us today, Liz Doland and Irene Fick and Margaret Foster. Let me turn to you, Liz, with a very personal question.
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel to sit there and offer a piece of your work, which I know can be very, very personal because it's something you have worked hard on and invested yourself in and listen to a group of your peers critique your work. And the other two of you, I'm going to ask you the same question. So,
Well, since I have been attending meetings for 15 years, I think I've become very thick-skinned. And so it doesn't bother me. If the critique is too positive, quite frankly, that bothers me more than a negative critique, because I want people to be tough and I want them to tell me what's working and what's not working.
Margaret?
I think it's, my reaction is, it's sort of like having your children with you at the doctor's office, and the doctor's looking and saying, well, maybe you've got this going on, and maybe you've got that going on. And I look at my kids, I go, yep, you're right. That's exactly what's going on, but I couldn't put my finger on it. So what's nice is you bring in a piece that you know needs something, and somebody puts their finger on it, and I'm really happy. I'm very appreciative of it. Sometimes I don't like the advice that I get, and I don't have to take it, and everyone feels the same way. It's your piece to work the way you want to. So I love it, and sometimes I bring in work that's bad to see if it's even salvageable, and I get really good advice on that, too.
Oh, that's really, really good. And, Irene?
I appreciate it, and I won't lie. And, you know, there are times where I bring something in and I think, wow, this is really good, and it turns out it's not. So, but I'm also aware I take it in the spirit in which it's given, and I value. The key point I should make is I really respect the people around the table, and I respect their views. So I take everything home, I look at it, and make some decisions. You know, do I go with this? And often the reviews or the critiques are excellent. Sometimes they're not, but that's my decision to make.
Would you recommend that most writers participate in some kind of group like that? Like, it seems to me that anyone who writes, even if you write for The New Yorker, somebody is going to read your work before it hits the public eye. Would you recommend this as a method for writers to use to improve the quality of their work?
I would, with some qualifications. I think it depends on where you are in the writing process and what you hope to get out of the critique group. If you're bringing your material in just to get applause and approval, then you're probably not ready for something like this. I think you have to be at a certain stage in your writing and be willing to accept, you know, constructive criticism and willing to give it as well.
Well, I certainly agree. I know for everything that I write, my daughter is my best critic, and she's also a literature professor, so she knows a little bit. But I produce these things that are really, really wonderful, and I send them to her. And when she calls me back and she begins the conversation with, well, I don't, I think, oh my goodness, I'm in trouble here. Yeah. I'm in trouble here already. Well, we're going to take a short break now. And when we come back, we'll hear some of the work of Liz Doland and Irene Fick and Margaret Foster. And all of them, I have to say, are established, published writers in their own right. But we'll be back in just a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back to DeMarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Poet Linda Blasky is my guest today, along with three members of the Coastal Writers, a critique group that meets in Rehoboth, Delaware. Irene, Liz, Margaret, and you too, Linda. you've all had varied and significant careers, and that have included writing. You've written and published prize-winning pieces, and I wondered if we can start with you, Liz, and if you would read a portion of your work for us. And let me first ask you a little bit about yourself. Tell me how you started writing and what your primary interest is in writing.
Well, I was an English teacher for 25 years in New York City. I also ran an alternative school, and I trained teachers, and my focus was always writing. But the only writing I did was academic writing. And it wasn't until I moved to Rehoboth full-time that I began writing, and I didn't start writing poetry until I joined the group and everything, and that's my real obsession. And everything I've learned about poetry, I have learned from that group, and it's free. So it's been a pretty wonderful experience for me. And I also have 10 grandchildren who all live on the next block in Rehoboth, so that's also great for me too. I brought a story today with me, a piece of fiction. I went to high school on 51st Street, Lexington Avenue in Manhattan, right across from the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, a Catholic high school, big high school, all girls, and we walked through the halls during change of period in silence in that time period. And this story is based on what I think is a true memory of a girl standing up and challenging a nun about birth control. And it is called The Conversion of Sister Terence. While Sister rattles on, I'm gazing at the white-suited worker on a swaying scaffold, steam cleaning the soot-covered walls of the Waldorf Astoria across the street. It seems that the man has been swaying on that scaffold since I entered high school, and that he raises and lowers it each day, shadowing whatever classroom I'm in. When I hear my name called, I jerk my head in Sister's direction. ¿Qué quiere decir, Isabel? Sister says. ¿Qué quiere decir? What does it mean, Sister? ¿Qué, hermana, Sister? Sister sighs. Pay attention, please. Your parents are making sacrifices to send you here, my dear. Not really, my dear, I want to say. I work on Saturdays to pay my $10 tuition. I know the next part of her speech by heart. I always mimic her at lunch till I have my classmates splitting their sides laughing. Sister tells us once again about her sainted parents who raised 10 kids and sent them all to Catholic schools. Half of them became priests and nuns. Blah, blah, blah. Each night they pray the family rosary on their knees, glorifying God. Dios, will she ever get back to the Spanish lesson? I glance back at my buddy Colleen, hoping she will mouth the answer to the question Sister asked me. But 5'9" Colleen is slowly rising from her seat, without raising her hand, without a nod from Sister's Mary Todd Lincoln black bonneted head. Great, I think. Colleen's going to answer the question. Hermana, she says, with her rouged cheeks and tangy red lips, already an affront to school rules. The three oldest boys in a family of nine hang around my stoop till 11 every night, smoking and drinking beer. They've already dropped out of Gomper's vocational. There isn't much glorifying of God going on in that Catholic family. Because Colleen and I live across the street from each other, I know the Barry family she speaks of. One boiling Bronx summer afternoon, the Barry boys organized a balloon fight. They filled cardboard boxes with them, ascended 5 flights to their roof, and dropped them on their enemies below. Things escalated. From nearby streets, hooligans showed up who tossed whole boxes of balloons and fiery newspaper torches into backyards, taking lines filled with laundry down with them. Then Vinnie Barry came careening up the street with a 3-foot silver fire extinguisher, spraying all of the neighborhood kids with foam. What had started out as fun had turned into a melee. The cops nabbed all 3 of the Barry boys and charged them with theft and destruction of private property. Of course, the fact that they smoke, drink, and get arrested only makes them more attractive. As a matter of fact, Colleen and I both have our eye on the oldest, Emmett, whose thick, dark hair and long eyelashes make us salivate. He looks like Elvis, has the same cocky walk and crooked smile. But I know Emmett has an eye for Colleen. Last Friday night at a parish dance, Colleen and he, his pack of luckies rolled up in his T-shirt sleeve, melted into each other to the beat of Earth Angel. After the dance, I walked home with them. Not that either of them noticed. From my bedroom window, I saw them making out under the eaves of the stoop. Then they walked toward Cypress Avenue. I waited for her to return until my head began to nod. The next morning, Colleen, puffy-eyed and pale as a scone, and I are on the subway heading to see a rock and roll concert at the Brooklyn Paramount. Whose idea was this, Colleen whines. Are we in Australia yet? Whose idea was this, I say? We've been saving our money for weeks to buy the tickets. Waiting online in the rain for 2 hours doesn't sweeten her sour mood either. Even Fats Domino and Jerry Lee Lewis don't help much. What's up with you, Colleen? Got your period or something? Nothing's up with me, she says, pulling up the hood of her trench coat as we leave the ornate theater. Maybe you're grouchy because you stayed out too late last night. What are you talking about? I'm talking about I saw you and Loverboy leave the stoop. I bend over to even the cuff of my jeans. Really, Miss Snoop? Well, you must have been dreaming. Don't accuse me of stuff just because you're jealous. Colleen is right. I am jealous. But I still saw her walk off that stoop with El Gaucho. Sister stiffens her back and closes her textbook as Colleen, framed by a bulletin board with our essays and paintings on Spanish traditions, continues, I think a little birth control might have helped that family out. What the hell? I am gasping. Birth control? Is Colleen heading for Bellevue? I look back at her again and grimace, hoping she will shut up. I want to raise my hand and tell Sister Colleen hasn't been herself for a while. I'm not sure who is more stricken by Colleen's rant, Sister whose plump cheeks purple, or her 30 students who turn their heads in unison towards Colleen, standing tall near the back of the room. I can tell by the deep breath she is taking. She has only begun. She continues like she's Masters and Johnson. I don't think every time a man and woman have intercourse, they have to intend to make a baby. Intercourse? She has actually said intercourse in front of a nun, in front of a sister of charity, a somber lot at best. Colleen might as well applaud Khrushchev's recent detonation of a 58 megatron hydrogen bomb. For some absurd reason, I begin making up Spanish words in my head for intercourse. Intercurso, medio curso, medio corrido. Oh, my friend, I think you will never see the inside of this classroom again. Sit down now, not while you are ahead, but before you are so far behind you'll never see your diploma either. You'll end up wearing a plaid peaked cap on your auburn DA. You'll end up serving nutted cream cheese and sandwiches at Chock Full of Nuts across from the 42nd Street Library. Even the lions will weep for you. As a matter of fact, Edmana, she continues, I wish my own mother had had access to birth control. She has 5 kids, does all the washing, ironing, cooking, and then runs every night to clean offices in the Channon building so she can pay her kids' tuitions. She rides home on the subway at 2 in the morning. I'm not sure when she sleeps. Really? Sister says sweetly, her 5 feet of solid flesh rising, her pudgy hands gripping the back of her slatted chair. "And which one of her 5 kids do you wish your mother hadn't had? You, perhaps? You who blaspheme in a classroom where a statue of the Virgin Mother herself stands? You who in the month of May brought a garland of daisies you wove with your own fingers to crown her Queen of Heaven? Colleen, who stands taller than every girl in the class, squares her broad shoulders, framing her huge breast, the envy of each and every one of us, and stands her ground. I lower my head and pray for Colleen and for myself. I think about how after Colleen gets expelled, I'm going to have to ride in the morning rush alone. I think about how the mashers, whom I always knew would have preferred targeting the voluptuous Colleen somehow, always managed to choose skinny, flat-chested me instead. With every rumble of the train, they would press against me. My left arm filled with textbooks, I would elbow them, but that would only encourage their ardor, the sorry jerks. Holding on to the overhead leather strap, I will not be able to signal Colleen to bellow, "Get lost, you creep." "Hermana," Colleen continues in a measured voice, "did you ever question why you became a nun?" I stretch my neck to see if Colleen looks glassy-eyed, having overdosed on caffeine or Midol. Maybe it's because you didn't want to become the slave your mother was. My God, Colleen is on a roll. I bet she never had time to get a PhD from La Universidad de Madrid. Did she even graduate high school? Colleen and I often joke that Sister Terence is so pompous she'd soon be hanging her diploma under the crucifix in our classroom, so we can bow our heads to that, too. "Sit down," Sister said, tightening the black bow of her bonnet. "I won't sit, Sister. I've listened to you for a whole year in 2 languages. Why can't you listen to me for 5 minutes? You don't know anything about love or God, for that matter. God is love, right?" "Right." I glance over at the steam cleaner, who is completely unaware of the drama taking place across the street from him. I wish he could swing his scaffold into our classroom and whisk Colleen away to safety like Superman. Like a train pulling into a station, Sister chugs down the aisle towards Colleen. Is Sister going to smack her with the force of 20 centuries of Roman Catholic authority behind her? I could picture the Pope on his Vatican balcony waving backwards, cheering her. Vive soror! Vive sister! Colleen, a head over Sister, stares down at her. They are close enough to hear each other breathe. I haven't seen anyone get walloped since our 5th grade nun smashed Bobby Barrett for calling Angela Hurley a fat-ass liar, which was God's honest truth. But instead of yelling at Colleen or smacking her, Sister looks up into Colleen's wide-set eyes, and she begins to cry. I mean cry. Cries that turn into sobs. Sobs that well up from her toes, out of her mouth, and shake her whole body. Some of our classmates start flipping through the pages of El Camino Real, probably hoping that someone, anyone, will continue the lesson with the simple Buenos dias, clase. Of course, Kissup Laverne, sitting right in front of me, is weeping too. At any moment, I expect her to rush towards Sister and throw her arms around her, ensuring her A for the year. Colleen almost smiles, the familiar whisper of a smile that tells me at this moment she feels powerful. She looks around at the stunned faces of her classmates, a college-bound class of sophomores, some of whom still think sex is Rock Hudson dry smooching, the helmet-haired Doris Day. Sister, her shoulders slumped, teeters out of the room. I can tell by the way Colleen's face softens. Her feeling of power has dissipated into one of total defeat. My God, she says, looking at us as though she were next in the line of command. They always win, don't they? They always win. At that moment, the fire drill bell sounds. Even though Sister is absent, we file out in silence, fly down 5 flights of stairs, out onto Lexington Avenue, and walk to the corner of 51st Street and halt at our appointed spot, right next to the entrance to the IRT subway. Because we know each other so well, Colleen and I know exactly what we are going to do, something heretofore we never would have dared, never would have considered. Instead of filing back into school for eighth period, we slip off the line and dash down the subway steps. On our daily subway rides, Colleen and I have always shared our feelings. What no one except me knows about Colleen is that she fell in love with Sister Parissima in second grade when, on the first day in class, she saw Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs in colored chalk on the blackboard. That day, she decided to become a nun, but the sisters have never seen her as a likely prospect. Maybe it's her voluptuous look. Maybe it's her outspoken nature. On the way home, I look at Colleen staring at the Miss Rheingold poster overhead. Maybe she's thinking about which mascaraed brunette she'll vote for, even though they all look alike. You know, Colleen, even though Sister is pompous, and I'm sick of hearing about her magnificent family, I hated to see her cry. I was stunned, too, when she started to cry, Colleen says. She's pompous sometimes, but she's a good teacher. Me gusta mucho español. I wish Colleen would explain why she mouthed off in class today. But maybe she doesn't know why herself. I believe she's sad about her mother's hysterectomy, but I think she's afraid to talk to her about it. Maybe she's afraid of what her mother might tell her. She says her parents have been arguing a lot lately. So unlike them, she says wistfully. And I think I'm not going to pressure Colleen into talking because I'm afraid of what she might tell me. As the train ascends from Manhattan Underground onto the elevated Bronx tracks, I'm always surprised by the beauty of the sky, no matter how gray the day, no matter how sooty the windows. I can hear the platters singing Smoke Gets in Your Eyes at the Friday night dance, and I think about the man on the scaffold. I see him in my mind's eye, a can of glass wax in his hands, polishing the windows, so Colleen and I can see the sky more clearly.
Two things strike me in your story. One, why did the sister cry? And two, what sense of power comes from defiance?
In order?
No, actually not in order, because we don't have a lot of time to explore them. But in your mind, at least, why did the sister cry?
I thought she cried because I think she was conflicted herself and she saw an element of truth in what the student said. Perhaps the student could have said it in a different way. And what comes from defiance? We had no voice. So at that point in time, you didn't stand up and do that. And here was someone doing it. And I think she did feel power, at least for a very brief period of time.
Excellent. Thank you. That comes out of that story very, very well. Irene, tell us a little bit about your background and what are you going to read for us today?
Okay, I was born in Brooklyn and raised in the Midwest, and I say that because it informs a lot of what I tend to write. I was trained and I worked as a journalist and in public affairs virtually my whole adult life, telling other people's stories. And I've always dabbled in poetry, but it was dabbling. It wasn't until I retired and moved to the beach full-time in 2010 that I discovered this wonderful, supportive community of writers. I joined the Rehoboth Beach Writers Guild, and Linda recruited me to come to the Coastal Writers 4 years ago, one of the best things I ever did. It has helped my writing quite a bit.
So what are you going to read for us today?
I'm going to read a few poems.
Okay.
And the first one is what I call a casserole poem. It basically takes several elements and puts them together. It started with my noticing there was a crippled snowbird outside my deck by the pond, probably shot by a hunter. And I also thought of the parrot that's in a cage at one of the hotels in Rehoboth. and it brought to mind some aunts of mine. So I will read this poem called Old Birds Down. Pity the parrot, shrouded and down for the night, a black curtain draped over her cage. By day, she is just another bauble in the lobby, where guests wait as their waterfront suites are primed. Oh, this old girl, this Ethel Merman of birds, should preen, wow us with an orgy of color, her wildest wings, a brassy voice that shrieks, look at me, look at me. Instead, she is a curiosity for tourists, her circadian rhythms parsed by the human clock. I recall Aunt Teresa, once lauded for her wit and throaty laugh, now tended by tired strangers behind the bolted doors of memory care. Her children agreed, here at least she is safe. Not far from the parrot's cage, the snow goose hobbles near the pond, a pearl in a bog of mud-colored Canada geese. This old bird went down when assassins stalked the fields, aimed high. I watch from the deck as she flaps her mangled wing, tries to soar again. I'm reminded of Aunt Adeline, half blind and deaf, braving a painful gait, how she clings to her home, dodges those bullets. When we hint of nursing care, she tells us, get lost, get lost. These grand old birds, captive or cripple, how they bear their wounds, settle down for winter's lonely curse.
Excellent.
I go on?
Yeah.
The next poem I'd like to read concerns a loss of faith, and that is the theme running through it.
Oh, we're back to the short story.
It's called A Requiem. Uncle Sal breathes again, safe in the embrace of a gracious God. So intoned the priest at his funeral mass, as mourners raised their arms, reached for a reliable heaven. After the burial, as we picked through the spread of sliced prosciutto and provolone, Cousin Nick declared his belief in dirt, nothing more. At the far end of the table, Cousin Paula begged for prayers, certain that God would listen, make her cancer disappear. And I, fresh from a canned tour of the Vatican, gave Aunt Katerina her coveted souvenir, rosary beads blessed by the Pope himself. I confess, I linger on the margins, easy prey for the lure of faith, the lure of the spirit, the notion of a divine force to seduce and soothe us with this vow. No matter how wretched our time on earth, we will live once more, reunite with our beloved dead. And yet, even as I long to sleep within the folds of my family's hand-me-down faith, I fear a cold and callous universe, a dark eternity of dirt, nothing more.
Excellent. But one more for us?
One more.
Okay.
This last poem is about my first marriage in a galaxy long, far away, long ago. It's called Before I Knew. The bargained bliss of wedlock began to wither before we unwrapped the last gift, before I whispered to Mom to keep the receipts, before I stacked the melamine dishes in the new hutch, color-coded the towels, stocked the kitchen with so many things I did not know how to use. At 19, what do you know? I knew this. The knot of dread as the bottles ran dry, as he cradled his Johnny Walker, silent and slack-jawed, on the new plaid sofa from Sears. I found his loaded gun, and I lost those hollow nights when he didn't come home. At 19, I was beginning to know too much. I plodded the mile back to Mom and Dad. They called the Italian attorney, Anthony something or other, the one with fancy suits and a full head of hair, to fix my failure, to begin to dissolve what began a year ago in a white march down a holy aisle, witnessed by family who flew in from back east, family who wished they had kept the receipts, for all those gifts, those pretty things that would help me set up house, all those pretty things I didn't know at 19 how to use.
Mm-hmm. Margaret.
Yes. Hi.
You were a teacher, photographer, writer. Tell us a little bit more about your background very quickly, if you would, and then what you're going to read for us.
Okay. Yeah, I've been a teacher for about 30 years, and most of that time I've taught writing or students with learning disabilities who are trying to read and write. And I think my passion for writing comes from helping people find their voice and talking about what they know. So just as everyone else said, at some point I came to this area and had some time to start to work on my own writing a little bit more, and found the group and enjoyed it. I was a very part-timer. I came once a month every in the summertime when I was here, and then finally when I moved down here permanently, I've been able to come more regularly. So that's how I got here. And my story is a short memoir piece that's getting longer by the day, but it's about a trip that I took to California when I decided to leave my work and leave my home in Maryland and try something new, and brought my dog with me to drive out to California and start over again. So that's it's called Round Trip. Prologue is, when I was 4, I ran away from home. I'd had enough of the rules. I was tired of things like no eating in your bed, clean the mud off your shoes, no playing with matches, and don't pull your sister's hair. Enough. So I just packed a bag one day like they did in the cartoons, hobo style. Find a square towel or a blanket to tie up your belongings, make little rabbit ears over a stick, or use a pillowcase. Pillowcase is easier. Open the dresser drawer that's yours and just dump things in your sack. The underwear with no holes, a copy of Alice in Wonderland hidden in the back, one stuffed animal, and a transistor radio. Put Spot in last so his eyes can see out. Get some food. Peanut butter sandwiches are best. Mom helps to reach the bread. Go back upstairs to see if your sister has anything that you'd really like to keep forever, but abandon that when she comes screaming into the room. Drop her favorite framed picture of a princess on the ground and close your eyes to brace for the hit. But she doesn't push. She doesn't grab. She's crying. Don't let her go, she screams. Hadn't expected that. With chest fully pumped, I pushed my way through the bedroom door with my bag correctly slung over my shoulder. I marched down the creaky stairs with a full view of my family sitting in the front room watching TV. They were probably watching The Wizard of Oz on a black and white TV. I pulled my weight against the heavy front door without looking back and left. My red high tops took deep steps as I picked my way down through my mother's rock garden in the front of the house. I turned left at the sidewalk, looked back to see the windows lit up in the dark, and sat down on the under the streetlight at the corner. A housefly buzzed in the misty air above my head, reminding me I wasn't allowed to cross the street alone. Day one, many years later, finally running away again. It's 7 a.m. this time. My hobo bags include a well-traveled suitcase, two underbed boxes, a carry-on, and two grocery bags. It's a new time and place, but the issues are the same. I'm tired of the rules. But this time, the rules are mostly mine. No hanging towels from the balcony, no refunds for missed appointments, no loud music. My 25-year-old son, Cole, quietly fills my bedroom doorway with his long, listless body. He blinks one sleepy eye and sports a wonderful case of bedhead and a small grin. It's a bit early in the morning for him as he pulls loose shorts over his loose boxers. Can I grab some of those for you? He asks and helps me with the heavier bags. A few mumbled words are shared with a quiet grin as we load the car. I give him a hug and a kiss at our weathered screen door and head down the splintered walkway alone. I don't pause to see if he will beg me not to leave like my sister did when I was younger. I just hope that he has the good sense not to text his friends the all clear before I've pulled out of the driveway. I have raised him and his brother, Sam, put them through college like a good mom, and now I need to set out on my own. I'm not bitter, and I'm not angry. I'm excited. I'm settling out on a meandering trip to California to decide what I want to do next in life. My dog thinks we're going to the grocery store. I begin this journey the same way I begin every trip, by folding myself into the driver's seat and planting two sandy shoe prints squarely on the floor mat. My Pandora is turned to cool jazz. Facing the pine frame sun as it frees itself from the horizon, I glance into my rearview mirror and say goodbye to the familiar crunch of tires on pebbles. Now the hum of highways will accompany me for days. Well, that along with the panting of my nervous dog in the back seat. His wavy black fur and white tuxedo chest are typical of his breed. Portuguese water dog, colon, high energy, comma, smart, comma, not a dog for beginners, period. I read this online only after he'd moved in. They forgot to mention bad breath. His fishy breath and shaky legs fill the air with the doggy questions. Why is my bed in the car? And why are there so many boxes here? His floppy ears perk up and his tongue hangs out as he looks from side to side as if checking for traffic on an empty Route 1. I head south to travel west. It's a longer route to California for sure, but I can avoid the ice storms that are gathering in the middle of the country. Besides, I get to ride along the Gulf Coast for most of my trip. No clear plans, I begin with my eyes wide open, my ears tuned to every sound, and my heart pumping solidly. This December morning brings a light drizzle, almost no traffic, and a quiet that I've only experienced on the eastern shore during the off-season. I've decided to take the road that leads to the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel, something I've never done before. People have warned me about how long it is, both acrophobic and claustrophobic, but I'm doing it despite my fears, just because I never have. I drive for miles passing Delaware farm stands that are closed for the season. Their grayness fades to color in my mind as I remember them filled with fruit just a few months earlier. Small hotels roll by my passenger window. A testament to the past, they linger like black and white postcards with frayed edges. Low-flying geese heading east glide in front of my lazy wipers. Their necks are long, their wing beats slow, accompanied only by the pulling sound of a jazz saxophone drifting from my radio and reassuring my shaky dog. Poor Nike. I tell him, "Come on, boy, get in the car." And he gets in with no idea where he's headed or how long he'll be there. How trusting. How screwed. Mind back on Route 1, I note every body of water, peaks of the sedate ocean, a glimpse of the quiet bay, even water standing in a culvert. I notice every forest dotted with pines, full of needles, as well as broadleaf trees barren after a frost. I assess each small town, its entryway, its city center, the playing fields, and their royal farms. As Delaware turns into Maryland, I place myself into each small town and wonder what it would have been like to grow up there, living in that house, going to that school, driving down those roads to see my friends. Sooner than expected, the ominous Bay Bridge Tunnel approaches, and my daydreams are interrupted with repetitive signs and increasingly frequent motels beckoning travelers to stay here, a gleaming rest area. I'm not sure if I should stop here or keep going. I don't know where the next rest area will be or how long either of us can last between stops. I wonder whether the Virginia Welcome area can compete with Maryland's proud rest stops. I glance in the rearview mirror to assess my furry friend. These are only a few of the uncertainties I need to work through as I begin this journey. I am surprised to see that the bridge part of the Bay Bridge Tunnel is much lower than I had imagined, and the tunnel is much shorter. I can see the opposite shore. The road dips down out of the drizzle and into the yellow light of the tunnel. No chance to let my mind wander. The lanes are narrow, the walls curved in above. Other cars move swiftly through, and I regrip my polished wood steering wheel and focus straight ahead. But in the depths of this enclosed darkness, the world suddenly pops open and I emerge in the middle of a bay. I'm on a low bridge just skimming the water. The sky arcs above me dotted with seagulls. Fishing boats bob on the bay, and watercraft dart around. I decide to capture the scene with my phone's camera, but I snap a photo of a state cop idling on a side lane instead. I hope to God he didn't see me. Phone down, eyes on the road, thoughts focused. It would be nice not to get a ticket or get killed on my first day out. A housefly in the corner of the windshield finishes the crossing in the clear coastal air with me. Only 122 miles from home, I begin to allow the towns and landmarks to pass by me now with much less attention. Instead, I fix my thoughts on keeping the glowing speedometer at exactly 9 miles over the speed limit. With a few odd turns on some back roads, I am soon weaving gently between cars going south on I-95. Signs in my rearview mirror mark the growing distance between me and the city of Richmond, just to my north. Pushing the speedometer a few more miles above the speed limit, I let the memories recede as the state lines zip like the ties on a railroad track. Ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk. Delaware, Virginia, North Carolina. The day grows longer as the shadows lengthen to my left. To my right, the semis weave rhythmically. My confidence and a kind of road calm begin to settle in. Nike looks more relaxed, too. Then, out of the shadows, as if by some minor god's unholy appetite for mischief, a jerk in a pickup truck hits a bump in the road and one of the sofas he's carrying goes airborne, and I have a front row seat. A front row seat that's traveling at precisely 74 miles an hour straight for it. My daydreams fly out through the moonroof. I switch into that emergency slow motion brain as the sofa rises into the air and the cushions magically separate from the couch. Cushions or couch, cushions or couch. Cushions, of course. I veer slightly toward a cushion as they take a bounce on the road in front of me and move apart with just enough space for me to pass right between them. I am pure fluid adrenaline held together by skin and gripping a steering wheel. My mama had once warned me not to worry too much about life, that the really horrible things would happen on some random Tuesday afternoon when you least expected it, and they would never be the things that you even thought to worry about. Check. I should be terrified. I should pull over and stop this journey. I should call someone. But I'd been through tragedy before. It has colored my reaction to danger in a very strange way. Sheer joy. Like winning a level in a video game, I watch as the cushions bounce along the highway in my rearview mirror and other cars veer and come to a stop. I laugh way too loudly, and I feel sweat bead at each of my hair follicles. It takes 5 more small-town exits before I allow myself to settle into the back of the seat. Looking at the time, I decide to call Sue, my friend and dinner host for that evening in Pontevedra. Hi, Sue. I'll be late for dinner. I thought that Google Maps lie, but apparently it really does take 12 hours to get from Bethany to Jacksonville. Sorry, so sorry. Go ahead and eat if you like. I'm good with leftovers. Yes, the traffic has been fine. Ugh. I decide not to tell her about the sofa incident. She'd just worry. Sue and I had worked together for years teaching students with learning disabilities. I loved that job, but leaving it became surprisingly easy when the thought of doing the same in a brand new place pulled at me. I used the remaining couch adrenaline to fly past 3 more state lines without stopping. South Carolina, Georgia, Florida. Ka-chunk.
All of you are clearly excellent writers, and I want to thank you, Linda, Liz, Irene, and Margaret, for joining us today on Delmarva Today Writers Edition. And I want to thank all of you for listening to Delmarva Today Writers Edition today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with their host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.